Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI.
So today, we're going to dive into a really challenging one, Anthony Burgess's 1962 novel, A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely a book that stays with you. Visually striking, disturbing.
And deeply philosophical, too. It really forces you to think about, well, human freedom, doesn't it?
It does. And to get A Clockwork Orange, you kind of have to get Anthony Burgess himself.
Yeah.
He wasn't just a novelist.
Right. He was this composer, a linguist, a polymath, really.
Exactly. And his Catholic background, that fascination with original sin, with free will, it's all baked into this story. The idea that you have to be able to choose evil for goodness to mean anything.
And you can feel the era it came out of, too, the early 60s.
Definitely. It sits alongside 1984, Brave New World, that whole dystopian tradition.
But it tackles control differently. There was this real anxiety back then about youth violence, wasn't there?
Yeah, rising delinquency. And overlaid with the Cold War tension, the state versus the individual. It's palpable.
So our mission today, I guess, is to unpack that central question Burgess poses.
Is forced goodness actually better than choosing evil freely?
Exactly. But before we even get into the plot, we have to address that big issue, the missing chapter.
Ah, yes. The elephant in the room. Chapter 21.
It's so important, isn't it? Because the American version and Kubrick's film, they end without it.
And that changes everything. It leaves you with this really bleak, cynical feeling. Alex is just doomed to be violent.
Whereas Burgess's original ending, with Chapter 21 included, offers, well, something else entirely.
It offers maturation, growth, chosen growth, not forced. It confirms his whole point.
So without it, it's mostly a warning about state control.
Primarily. With it, it becomes this defense of human dignity, of choice, even the messy process of growing up.
Okay, so let's get into the story itself. Part one, the aesthetics of ultraviolence, as you put it. We meet Alex.
Our narrator. And what a narrator. He's 15, charismatic, smart.
He loves classical music.
Deeply. And he's also a terrifying sociopath, an artist of chaos almost.
And that artistry comes through in the language straight away. Nadsat.
Nadsat, yeah. Burgess's invented slang.
It's brilliant. This mix of English and Russian words, droogs for friends, moloko for milk.
Porosho for good. Mm. It gives everything this strange, poetic, almost alien feel.
But it's unsettling too, right? Because the language is so stylized. Does it maybe distance us from the brutality? Make it easier to stomach?
That's the gamble Burgess takes, I think. It does distance the acts, maybe, but it pulls you right inside Alex's head. You're experiencing the world through his warped perspective.
And that perspective includes this intense love for classical music, Beethoven especially.
Ludwig van, as he calls him, the Ninth Symphony. It sends him into ecstasy.
Which is maybe the most disturbing part, this high art, this beauty. It's the soundtrack to his violence.
It really hammers home that uncomfortable idea that art itself is amoral. It can exist alongside utter depravity. It doesn't automatically make you good.
So part one lays this all out. We see Alex and his droogs, Pete, Georgie, and Dim.
The slow one, Dim.
Right. Drinking the Moloko Plus at the Korova Milk Bar, getting ready for a night of, well, ultraviolence.
And Burgess doesn't shy away from showing it. The attack on the old scholar.
The home invasion. That horrific assault on the writer, F. Alexander, and his wife. It's brutal.
It is.
Yeah.
And that incident with F. Alexander becomes crucial later on. It sets up this whole cycle.
Alex is completely unrestrained here, choosing evil freely. But then things start to unravel within the gang itself.
Yeah, Georgie starts challenging Alex's leadership. Wants more discipline, more profit from their crimes, less random mayhem.
That tension builds. And it leads to Alex's downfall. He commits one last impulsive crime.
Murdering the wealthy cat lady.
And his own droogs betray him. Dim smashes a bottle in his face just as the police sirens are wailing.
A really sudden, harsh betrayal. And just like that, Alex's reign of terror is over. He's caught.
Which brings us to the core conflict, prison, and the offer of a way out.
He's facing a long sentence. And then he hears about this experimental treatment, the Ludovico technique.
He volunteers, right? Sees it as a quick ticket back to the streets.
He totally misses the philosophical implications. He just wants out of prison. The state, represented by Dr. Brodsky and the Minister of the Interior, they see it differently.
As an efficient solution to crime.
Exactly. A way to cure criminals, make society safer. Utilitarianism taken to an extreme.
Let's talk about the conditioning itself, because it's truly chilling.
Oh, it is. They strap him into a chair, clamp his eyes open.
So he has to watch.
He has to watch these incredibly violent films for hours on end. And while he's watching, They inject him with a drug that causes extreme nausea, sickness, pain.
But the real violation, the thing that targets his soul, is the soundtrack.
Yes. They play his beloved classical music, Beethoven, Bach, over the images of violence.
So they link his deepest passion, the source of his aesthetic joy, directly to unbearable physical sickness.
It's not just behavior modification, it's spiritual destruction. They're deliberately corrupting what he holds sacred.
And amidst all this state-sanctioned cruelty, there's one voice speaking out against it.
The prison chaplain. The churl, Alex calls him.
He's sort of the unexpected moral center of the book.
He really is. He argues passionately that what they're doing is wrong, even if it stops crime. He gets the core issue.
What does he say? The famous line.
When a man cannot choose, he ceases to be a man. He understands that taking away choice, even the choice to do wrong, is dehumanizing.
It strips away the very essence of being human. The state wants efficiency, order.
At the cost of the individual soul. They're creating, essentially.
The Clockwork Orange.
Precisely. Something that looks organic, natural, like an orange on the outside.
But inside, it's just machinery, clockwork.
Yeah.
Controlled, predetermined, not alive in any meaningful moral sense.
It's goodness, because it's forced, becomes meaningless.
Yeah.
And the state proudly presents this mechanism as a success.
And they release him back into the world, cured. But what happens next is just devastating.
It's an immediate, brutal reversal.
Hmm.
Alex, the former predator, is now completely helpless.
He can't fight back because violence makes him physically sick. Even hearing his music makes him ill.
His past comes back to haunt him instantly. First, the old scholar he attacked finds him and beats him up with other elderly victims.
And then the irony gets even thicker. He's rescued by a police officer.
Who turn out to be Dim and Billy Boy, another old rival, his former droogs, now agents of the state.
And they take him out to the countryside and beat him mercilessly.
Which really underscores that theme of the irony of punishment. The state's enforcers are just as brutal as the criminals they're supposed to control. The system mirrors the violence it claims to fight.
It's a terrifying cycle, and it doesn't stop there. Beaten and desperate, Alex collapses at a cottage.
And whose cottage is it? F. Alexander's, the writer.
The man whose life Alex shattered in part one.
Initially, Alexander doesn't recognize him. He sees Alex as a victim of the government's brutal conditioning program.
He wants to use Alex's story politically, right? To expose the government?
Yes. He and his anti-government friends see Alex as a perfect symbol. A martyr. But then, recognition dawns.
Alexander realizes who Alex is.
And any compassion vanishes. It turns into cold, calculated revenge. Manipulation. The victim becomes the victimizer, in a way.
He's no longer seeing Alex as a person, just a political tool.
Exactly. A pawn to bring down the government he hates. So they lock Alex in a room.
And blast Beethoven's Ninth Symphony at him, knowing it will trigger the unbearable nausea.
It's psychological torture. Turning his greatest love into an instrument of pain. It's so cruel that Alex is driven to.
Attempt suicide. He throws himself out of the window.
Which, of course, creates a huge political scandal. The government can't have their cured patient killing himself.
So to save face, they reverse the conditioning.
They undo the Ludovico treatment. Alex is cured of his cure, his capacity for violence, his old self is restored.
And this is where the film ends.
Yeah.
And the American version of the book. Alex smirks, thinks about violence, and the implication is nothing has changed. He's back to square one.
It's incredibly cynical, a very dark view of humanity as inherently corruptible or fixed in its ways.
But that's not Burgess's final word. We need to talk about chapter 21.
Yes, the true ending. After the conditioning is reversed, Alex does initially try to go back to his old ways. He forms a new gang. But the thrill isn't there anymore. It feels pointless. Immature. He's growing up.
Naturally. Without state interference.
Exactly. And the turning point is when he bumps into Pete, one of his original droogs.
What's Pete doing?
Pete's settled down. He's married, has a job, speaks normally. He's just moved on, living a normal adult life.
And seeing that makes Alex realize
that the whole ultra-violence thing was a phase.
Yeah.
Youthful energy misdirected. He realizes he wants something different now, too. Maybe what Pete has.
So the change isn't forced by the state. It comes from within. It's just growing up.
Which completely validates the chaplain's argument. True change, true maturity has to be chosen. It can't be mechanically imposed. Burgess ultimately affirms that possibility of redemption through choice.
Okay, so let's try and pull together the big themes, especially with that final chapter in mind. First and foremost, free will.
Absolutely central. Burgess insists that the ability to choose, even to choose badly, is what makes us human. Morality isn't real if it's not a conscious decision.
You have to face temptation and choose good for it to count.
Right. Second, that stark irony of punishment.
Yeah, the state's methods were just as dehumanizing, just as brutal in their own way as Alex's crimes.
Society can become the monster it tries to fight. The cure becomes another form of violence.
And third, that complex relationship between art and morality.
Alex shows us art doesn't inherently make you good. It's amoral. It can coexist with terrible things.
But the tragedy of the conditioning was how the state deliberately corrupted that weaponized beauty against him. They attacked his spirit.
Destroyed his capacity for aesthetic joy, which is maybe the cruelest act of all.
And the style itself, that first-person Nadsat narration, it puts you, the reader, in such an uncomfortable spot throughout.
It forces you to confront these questions directly. What price are we willing to pay for social order? Is safety worth sacrificing the essence of humanity?
The novel really challenges us to think about whether forcing people to be good is ever justifiable. It suggests, ultimately, that real growth, real change, has to come from inside, freely chosen.
That messy, unpredictable, but ultimately authentic human choice is what Burgess champions in the end. That faith in growth, not coercion.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.